And actually, it's quite an inefficient sector, in my experience.
I think
there's a massive gap, though, isn't there, between the really small local charities who have absolutely nothing and the big national charities, which seem to be spending willy-nilly on press advertisement, TVs, and people must look at them and think, all that money, surely that should be going back into, you know, where it should be going.
Yeah, professional fund writers and bid writers in most big charities that earn fortunes. If you're someone who has a TV that says, I have a track record of every time I've written a big lottery fund application, I've won it. Like, charities will pay fortunes for that. It's a real skill. It's a bit like if you're the kid at school who knows how to pass the exam, but you're not necessarily the smartest kid in the school, but you know how to get from A to B better than anyone else. And fund writers are like that. They can charge fortunes because the difference between survival and failure with a charity is that one big bid.
The lottery bid.
Well, quite often, if you're a medium-sized charity, you'll get your management accounts and your financial director will say, "We're looking at 200 grand shortfall this year," and then if you're in a position to be able to go to the big lottery fund and get a 4-year grant for. That's the one charity, and it's a national body that can do that type of money for the right idea. But if you can't go through the process, you can't write the bid, you don't know what you're talking about, like, you've got no chance. But if you can employ someone on a 50 grand salary to write that bid, secure it, they'll do none of the delivery.
Now we know where all the money is going.
It's such a strange world. We also had a chief exec who was basically pissing money up the wall, like no tomorrow. The charity I worked for had a £10 million grant over 10 years. There were 52 of these bodies that were set up around the UK. It was a Tony Blair idea, New Deal for Communities, it was called, and they were set up in neighbourhoods that were considered the 50 most deprived neighbourhoods in the UK.
Yeah.
So it was the first time it was considered innovative because it's the first time money of that significance has been spent at a micro level. It always gone to local authorities to then distribute across. They set up charitable bodies in 50 neighbourhoods around the country and said, right, you got 10 million quid over sorry not 10 million quid 50 million quid over 10 years. And and these were resident led boards. Quite often didn't have a clue what to do with the cash. So when I first got involved, it was straight after graduating. I worked for a private sector company. We used to go into these institutions. And
so these were volunteers, these groups?
They had to be resident-led boards. The chair had to be a local resident. You were expected to build a board that was like a mixed portfolio of expertise, so local business owners, people from statutory bodies. And you were meant to have a professional management team delivering the work, reporting to board level. But the idea was you're giving all this cash to the neighbourhood itself to disseminate around themed areas.
On places they knew better than the locals.
Yeah, so they had to develop a health programme, employment programme. There was always a stream around education of young people. I got involved in it because we were coming in and we were evaluating some of these programmes.
As a researcher. Yeah.
Wasting money left, right and centre, most of them.
I don't want to stop you in your
flow. Sorry, go on. No,
on the basis that we don't know who's in here at the moment. Tracy, you're in here, the van.
Good morning.
Good morning. This is Tracy and Ben. And we're in the van outside the depot. Right, so we're five minutes already in.
Oh, right. I didn't realise we were being filmed.
Thanks for the heads up.
Yeah, no.
You could have said anything.
Didn't mention any names, luckily.
No, it's interesting on the basis that, you know, this is an experience, you know, and that's the whole point of this. So, right then, caught you in the flow.
Yeah.
So we've gone our charity bits.
Yeah.
Tracy said to me, as we came out here, I'm going to lob her in here now. I really like to talk to Ben. So that's idea. So coming here this morning, as you know, we were talking about communicating.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say nothing. I keep saying this. Nothing now.
Oh, this is where you have radio silence when you deliberately say, "Right, this is it, talk." Yeah,
feel
that airtime.
So it's very difficult. Quite interesting when you're doing these conversations. Where do you start or stop?
Yeah,
And it's actually become a feature, rather than a negative. And I mean, I know you said there was some strange silences at the beginning, and people weren't quite sure. But I spend most of my time turning the volume down after about 3 or 4 minutes as people warm up.
Yeah.
I suppose it's warming into things.
Yeah, just to, but you know, conversations, how do people.
Yeah. No, so no agenda whatsoever. We just talk about absolutely anything, is the idea. Okay.
See, that's when it puts you on the spot.
I know.
I mean, you said in the depot bakery this morning, do you want to speak to Ben? Yeah, I'll speak to Ben, because he'd already done a really good presentation on his business, and it's really good to speak to other business owners or hear their journey, because you can really relate it to what each person's going through and their life journeys, their business journeys. And I think whoever you speak to, you can relate some aspects to your own.
Yeah, I think it's always, I always think people are always hesitant to talk about themselves as business people, because it can quite often just lapse into talk. It's a bit like you go on holiday, you talk about your own holiday, and you think, oh, half an hour's gone by, and this person surely is bored. But there'll always be something within that conversation where someone goes, oh yeah. I went there and I had a great time, and there's always something that falls out of it. It's just sometimes a bit of an uncomfortable state for me to just talk about my experiences, because you worry that 90% of it's just irrelevant.
I think,
if 10% of it's useful, then at least it's.
But I think a lot of people are quite reluctant to say or explain the problems they've had in business or things they might have done wrong.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to admit that could have been a failure in your business, even though you're still doing well.
Yeah.
You don't always want to admit, well, actually, that didn't work, and I had to ditch that. Or, you know, because you just want to come across that everything's fine all the time and doing really well, because you don't want to come across as though something might be slightly failing in the background.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You know, it's like that perception. You've always got to put yourself forward as being successful all the time.
Yeah.
In case it puts people off coming and using you, which is probably a totally wrong way of looking at it. But when you hear another person's journey and you think, oh, that didn't quite work, but it's how you overcome the problem of something not working, whether it's in business or life, admit where it might be going wrong and take it on a totally different direction.
Yeah.
Or just rejig.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ability to spot that something's going wrong is a skill in itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people perhaps don't have the understanding of the business, the closeness to the business, to even spot those problems a lot of the time. So, I mean, my view's always that I've always been pretty open to admitting your own limitations, because otherwise it's vanity, really. If you put yourself in a position where you pretend everything's fine and everything's cool, it's a form of vanity in my eyes. Like, you should always be quite open. And I mean, I think I'm quite self-deprecating anyway, where you just go, like, if you're rubbish at something, just turn it into a bit of a joke and have a laugh. And I think one of the beauties of business is you're never too far away from someone who does know the answer to a problem. So that might be someone in your business who's, you know, in our settings, like, we've got people who've worked in hospitality for 10, 15, 20 years. So they'll have come across the same problem before, and they'll have had a learned experience from that you can borrow from. So you should always be open to talking to people within your business. But then equally, you know, you come to forums like this where there's a huge wealth of knowledge around completely different sectors and completely different interests.
You're mixed up a bit. It's the whole thing, isn't it? You're not talking to the same. But I was just really interested in what Tracy thinks, because these networking things are proliferated everywhere.
there's a massive saturation of them at the moment,
isn't there?
Yeah.
And to be honest, 90% of them are sycophantic, I think.
Yeah.
And I'd be critical in that people are saying, you know, we're the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Yeah.
You know, we've been earlier, are amazing. But this one is interesting. I think it's much more interesting because I've been coming here and I've tried, because it's much more open. We can,
yes.
You know, people will sit there and not laugh at your failures, but sympathise. So when you said, I mean, something Ben said earlier was which resonated with me, was that, you know, people are forever telling you what you should be doing. And most of the time, it really is rubbish.
Yeah.
Because they don't, you know, they've got their heart in, you know, they're really thinking that you're helping you.
Yeah.
But I find it a bit of a, you know, a strain that people who are not in the business or not are sort of advising you. Whereas here, I throw out ideas, you know, and come back, you know, and challenge people or challenge myself. And
yeah.
And then here, as people are willingly, I think, from what I've found, are willing to go, well, actually, you know, I've really struggled with this. You know, maybe being a bit more honest about it.
Yeah.
I think that's finding a platform where you do feel comfortable with the people that are around you, because they're not there to judge you. And I think I do quite a lot of different networking events, and you have to find the one that's going to work for you as well, and surrounding yourself with the people that you need to be around. Mm-hmm. But I've found probably a couple of events where you do actually get to know the other business owners as friends, not just another business. And I think that's when you can open up, and it's like a platform where you feel comfortable to actually say, look, I'm having this problem this week, has anyone got any advice? And you feel that relaxed around them, that you can actually voice these concerns and get all this different feedback. Yes, some of it might not be relevant, but then you can pick and choose what you're going to take on board, which is going to be useful to you and your business. But not all networking events are like that.
They're not. No.
Then you'll come across somewhere it's hard selling. And for me, that is, whoa, back off, you know. You're not going to tell me. I don't even know you.
I mean, I have a hesitance to go to networking events, full stop, because that's my experience. And there's too many people in the room that are pitching.
And you're just sometimes not in the mood
for being subject to that. You get the right ones. Yeah. They're just great places to share experiences.
I think actually, the people that do hard sell to you don't usually stick to the same events.
They're kind of like networking tarts, aren't they?
They're just in and out of every single...
They're
actually in and out of every single event and just seeing if they can do a hard sell there and then move on to the next group. In my experience, that will never work. It's that trust. People do buy from people.
Yeah.
You've got to get to know and like that person, but it builds up that trust.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can hear other people saying, "Oh yeah, I've used that person, that business, they're really good."
Yeah.
And it goes a long way.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're your own personal brand as well.
I mean, it's funny that networking event only came about because when we first moved here, like Mark was one of the first customers we would see regularly.
Did you work in here then? Yeah, we were often
the strategy initially when we moved down here was that we had a rent on the building that made sense if we just focused on wholesale, and we didn't really need the cafe to do that much business. We didn't expect to. We're in an old industrial yard that you can't see from the road, and we didn't really expect to have that much of a response to the cafes. It's steadily grown, but Mark was one of the first people that would come in regularly, and he'd always make a point of thanking Mike for the poached eggs and saying they're the best poached eggs in Sheffield. And he was always very vocal about it, and we had a bit of a laugh and a joke in the background. We were always a bit like, oh, it's that guy that loves the poached eggs, isn't it? And then you just get to know him. And this proposition came about because Mark was obviously comfortable enough to say,
"Yeah,
I want to do this thing. Amazing. I love it here." And that was just a natural conversation. And then I suppose in if you look at that as an outsider, we're doing business together in some ways, aren't we? But we're just facilitating each other's ideas and interests.
You're being honest about a venue, about breakfast, saying it as it is, basically.
It is really nice to host this because Mark loves the venue. He's almost like he's a spokesperson for our place, better than we can sometimes.
Yeah, so it's great.
He's got no agenda, so like it's more powerful, isn't it? If Mark comes in and says, I think it's the best place in Sheffield for breakfast, it's so much more powerful than me saying it, because clearly I've got a vested interest in saying that. You know, it's why would we stand in the way of Mark bringing more creative, interested people into the venue? It's a lovely thing to do. So I mean, we had a lot of people rolling eyes about having to do a 7 a.m. start. Steve's been great because he just gets on with it. He's there most Tuesday mornings, isn't he?
You didn't challenge them before that, you know, say you've got to start work at 7 now.
Well, the bakers are in at the irony is the bakers are in at 4 a.m. every morning.
Four. Are they?
Yeah, everything's fresh, baked fresh in the morning, so they have to get all that product to different cafes in.
There's a natural sort of flow, isn't there? I didn't know what time a baker started, for example.
Can't you make a 10 minute switch? There's different models. There's a lot of people who bake overnight, so you see a lot of bakeries will do a night shift, get most of the product ready for 4, and then they might do a 3 hour delivery.
Well, that's kind of I understood it.
And then the risk with that, that there is actually potentially, if you think about some of the products, if they're selling in a cafe at say 5-6 o'clock in the afternoon, early evening, they've potentially been made like 17-18 hours before.
Yeah.
And this is when I talked about, we noticed the drop in quality. Basically, the main bakery we used to use went from doing a 2-3 a.m. open shift in the bakery to doing night shifts and starting at 6 p.m. And we straight away, the croissants that were coming to us first thing in the morning were already dry.
Yeah.
We spotted it straight away and we're like, what's happened here? And then someone in the know said, oh, they've changed their... Change of shifts, didn't tell anyone about it.
Thinking that nobody would notice.
Yeah, it was interesting.
With food, you do notice.
It was really interesting. We didn't know what the problem was, but we spotted that the end result was that just the quality seemed to have dropped. So there isn't a lot of choice. You're a bakery that doesn't bake fresh, and you can do that whenever, normal day shifts, or you do a night shift, and there's some reasons why you might choose that. Our delivery schedule's tight. Like, we sometimes get to places a little later than we should, because if there's a problem with a bake, or if the dough hasn't proved properly, you have to wait a little bit, and then you're tightening the delivery a bit. But we found it's the best way, and I mean, it's hard enough getting people to turn up for work at 4 a.m. I think it'd be even harder if you had people working a night shift. I think personally, I think that's a harder sell to try and get bakers to.
Just coming back to your idea of customers, because you know, I'm laughing because, you know, we're sat in a vehicle that people recognise. They recognise it not as me, but as a vehicle.
Yeah.
And they identify. You know, you kind of end up. So you're when you're joking about Mark turning up and he was the guy who loved the poached eggs.
Yeah.
I bet you had a nickname for him as well.
Well, I think he was just. It was possibly. I think he was just like Poached Egg Man. Like, it's as literal as it gets. It wasn't anything derogatory.
Because I was joking about. Because I mean, it's not the greatest thing. You know, you stood up on your feet all day and everybody else, and you see this people. So you start creating worlds around your business.
Yeah.
No, we were joking because one time in Hathersage, we went into a cafe. And the lady who runs it said, oh, you know, hi there, everything else. How's Laptop Man? And we went, who the hell is Laptop Man? you know, he's with you every week. I said, no, he isn't. Nobody, you know. We just couldn't work out. So in the end, we actually went on to, you know, we were talking about LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And found a photograph of all of the people we thought might be this fictitious laptop. Yeah. After about 10 minutes, we got, oh, that's him there. Yeah. Oh yeah, we know. Yeah. Well, you know, we just. But then it started the whole thing off. I said, right. So I started asking, like I've just asked you, you go to your favourite bakery. I hate to tell you this, but Roses is up the road.
Yeah.
From us, so I go in there, and they knew me from the van.
Yeah,
and so I said, "What do you call your customers? Have they got nicknames? And they're not derogatory, as you say.
They're just
affectionate on the basis you're there on a regular basis."
Yeah,
and they said, "Oh yeah, of course we do." So like it was normal.
They can often be quite complimentary, I find.
Well, they said they can. Well, they used to come in.
You're so conditioned in a customer environment like that.
Yeah.
you'd never come up with a nickname that was
no, it's really, you
would be worried about. Yeah, yeah, there's lots of affection.
So they came with this idea, and they said, you never know what we call you. And I said, no, well, okay. I was really waiting for the kick in the head. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, oh, you're E.T. Sort of Planet Zulon, E.T. and all this, you know. I thought, oh, okay.
Wrong with that.
Yeah, no, it is strange, yes. But, you know, I can see where it came from. It was entertaining just the way they did it.
I've got a little photo on my downstairs toilet wall. It's my downstairs toilet art gallery, as I call it. Just all the framed.
This is going somewhere else.
Yeah, no, yeah. Downstairs toilet now.
It's just all those framed photos that you're never going to put in your lounge necessarily, but things that you think are interesting.
For the lounge
yeah,
wall.
Just they all go in the downstairs toilet. So we've got a bit of a collage of photos and. When I spent so much time at Tampa as a customer that their nickname for me was they got to know my first name, but they didn't know anything else about me. They'd see me coming in and chatting, having clandestine conversations with John about various things, about future business prospects and things. So they just called me Mr. Ben because obviously the children's character. And then I went in with my wife once, and they called. They wrote on the takeaway cups, Mr. Ben and Mrs. Ben. And she came out, and she's like, what's all this about? And as I took a photo of it, put it on my Instagram, it's now on the wall, but I went back in the next morning, I said to the Brit, I said, you know, that's not actually my wife, you know. Just to tease him, and he was like, oh, shit. Have I caused a problem? Oh, no, have I caused a problem? I was like, no, actually, it is. I just wanted to say you were being quite presumptuous there. But it's nice, isn't it? I think it's nice that people recognise you. I think so many customers are used to quite faceless environments now. Yeah. You go to certain places and it's so robotic, and it's so like you're in, you're out. It's very transactional. And one of the easy ways for someone like us to stand out is to just be a little bit more personable.
Oh yeah, that was one of the key things, you know, I mean, never mind that, you know, reading books about setting up small businesses, is that personal relationship.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
This is what you're saying, you know, you're not trying to take over the world. So what you need is really good core customers that they trust you, you trust them.
Yeah, and exactly.
Do you work on your
it's just
one woman band
it's just me and the business at the moment, which is kind of how I like. You haven't got the hassles of employing.
sorry
for any employees, but but what I found, people generally will buy from me because I'm out there and people get to know me, and I'm genuine. I'm upfront about who I am and what I do. You know, there's no smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
And I think people do generally warm to that. You know, I'm not trying to blow smoke up my own arse or anything.
Right.
But it is genuine. It really is genuine. Mm. Yeah. And people buy from genuine people.
Yeah.
I'm not hiding behind anything. And it's nice to get out there and meet different people as well. Like I say, working by yourself in a business, people say, oh, it must be really lonely, I could never do that. I'm really disciplined when I'm working, and I like the total quiet, and I can just concentrate and get on. Mm-hmm. But people say, well, yeah, but you're not talking to anyone. But I go out networking all the time.
Yeah, or, you've got,
you know,
nice,
I've got clients
balance.
Ringing me, or, you know, I'm in contact with people all the time. So that's never really an issue.
Yeah, that's good.
So there's not that loneliness. Because I, you know, when I need to be quiet and concentrate and get on with the work, I can do that. But when I need to be out there promoting the business, chatting to people, getting business advice, not just going out, you know, getting new business in, it's getting different advice from different people and chatting to people. But one thing they always say as well, when you go out networking, you know, it doesn't cost anything just to smile and say hello to every single person you come across.
Yeah.
Like you were saying, you can go into some cafes or, you know, any venue, and there's no interaction.
No.
They're like robots. They might maybe they don't enjoy what they do.
Yeah.
I don't know, and it's a chore to be there, but it would make the day go much quicker for them if they just interact and have a chat to someone. Because there's a lot of interesting people out there, and you don't know yeah. anything about these.
You can't be close to that.
It's like you were saying, you know, people will know you, and you know they'll know what you have to drink because you're in there constantly. They know what you have to eat, and they're really friendly and have a little chat. They'll give you a nickname, but they don't actually know your real name and anything else about you. But you feel like you know each other.
Yeah.
Just by that repetition of seeing each other, even just, you know.
Yeah, and like, I have kind of two personality types on this, because I love that. I love knowing a place where, you know, whether it's your local pub or whatever, where you can go in and you know you are a familiar face, and you know you can sit and chat. And but I also crave anonymity in hospitality environments. Sometimes you just want to go to a place where, like, there's no expectation that anyone knows you, and you can just be alone. And I think
you can just go and sit quietly.
Yeah, like have a newspaper, read a newspaper, not be bothered. Mm. And I think I would argue most people, depending on what side of bed you've got out of that morning, what crave both those experiences.
Yeah.
And actually, it's also true that a place like that needs to recognise that sometimes, because you can go too far the other way. You can be too familiar. And you can put people off, and being able to read reading when some people have a natural disposition to just fade into the background a bit, just want to go for a coffee, do what they want, or if it's a networking session, they're there for a purpose, they don't necessarily want all the razzmatazz that goes with it. How do you read whether someone's in that space or not? You can only do it by you're encouraging people to just have a personal relationship and read people's body language, whatever it is. Yeah. And that's what a lot of like high street businesses miss. You can't train out someone's human instinct, because you know, if you tell them that they've got to do something in a regimented way every morning to every customer, and then someone comes in and you're reading the face and you're like, they don't want this. Mm. I know they don't want it. You still got to do it. Yeah. It's just ridiculous, isn't it? So
I've had that experience at bed and breakfast places.
Yeah.
So you go and you come down for breakfast. I mean, I'm too not much. So bad. I will have it actually chat to people, but my husband hates it. He doesn't want to talk to this person he doesn't know.
Yeah.
We're like totally two flips of the coin.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you'll get the owner of the B&B coming to you at breakfast and chatting and going on and on. I'm thinking, I mean, up to a certain point, there should be a cut-off point. I'll have a quick chat, but you are sat there going to have breakfast. You don't want them sat with you as such, chatting to you all through breakfast. And, you know, if they could read my husband's body language, they wouldn't come anywhere near. Because he's obviously, go away. I want to eat my breakfast in peace. So, yeah, you have got to try and read people. Because some people will just talk at you constantly. Sometimes there's no
isn't that a nervous thing? I've had that in bed and breakfast. They literally come and sit down with you and you go, oh, who are you?
Just bring my breakfast and that's it.
I get that bit, but also isn't this idea of when you people what perceived as this as who you are in the businesses? I mean, Costa is the one that like really gets me. That's the robotic thing. I don't go in very often because I don't feel comfortable in it. But it all came about when they advertised for someone behind the counter, and they called, you know, I think they called it a coffee assistant or something like that.
Yeah.
And they got no applications at all for this job. But when they put it back in again, somebody said they advised and said, well, it's a barista.
Mm.
Yeah.
They got 800 applications.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, people were turning up thinking that, you know, getting us training, and then you see them. And this is probably Costa going to kill you, but you know they don't look like they're enjoying what they're doing.
Yeah.
They're going through the mechanics.
Yeah.
They write, you know, because they forgot to write on those cups and all that stuff. You know,
it's more of a Starbucks thing
Starbucks started off.
Costa have the same like quite mechanical processes. Yeah. Oh, I mean, there's a place for that. There's a place for it because I suppose it's that thing. It's familiarity. If you're in the middle of nowhere and you see a Costa, you know what you're going to get. Now, you might not choose in your hometown. I would never choose to go there because you know there's so many superior experiences. If I'm in the middle of nowhere and I see a Costa sign or a Starbucks sign, you might go, well, it's better than taking a punt on something that might be bloody awful. So I'll go for that.
Would you do that? Right.
Okay. John at Temper, my business partner, kills me for this because I will drink Starbucks from a service station quite regularly because I know it's not going to be the worst coffee in the world I've ever had. I know it's not going to be the best. I know exactly what I'm going to get, and if I'm content with that,
there's a business model, and he absolutely drills me on it. Yeah,
Why would you have something that's inferior to what you know you could have if you waited a bit longer? His view. And there's
drive up the motorway into.
Yeah, well, he'd just say, just don't have a bloody coffee. He'd go into Starbucks and have a bottle of water.
Oh, I see. Right.
You know, because it's worse than the other bottle of water that you're going to have from.
If you sat down with the top guys at Starbucks and said, you know, what they want. What the image they wanted to put over? That's precisely what it is. That's the brief.
That's their market segment, and they do it very well.
Holiday Inn is another one. You know, people book Holiday Inn because they get the same coloured doors and the same coloured walls, and you know, that's what they want. They don't want the interaction.
You know what you're getting.
So there's an. You know, how do you?
Yeah, we me and my wife have this. We have a bit of a laugh at the moment because our kids absolutely love staying in Premier Inn hotels. My joke is like there isn't a better purple hotel in the world because everything's purple. The kids love that everything's purple. Yeah. You go for a breakfast in the morning, which is in many ways purple. if it wasn't built into your room price, you'd never pay $11.99 for a Premier Inn breakfast in my eyes. But you become actually quite. Emotionally attached to it because you see the kids are all enjoying it and you're like, well, I can have free top ups on the coffee, and the coffee's pretty bland, but you can actually have a relationship with those type of experiences because they know what they are, they're successful at what they do. They don't strive to be anything else, they deliver that pretty well.
As
a family that are driving around the country and you've got to have somewhere to stay that's next to where your relative lives or whatever, you go to a Premier Inn. You don't have any other fuster. You're searching for an independent B&B and hoping you get it right. You get it wrong.
Oh no!
You know exactly what you're going to get. You know what you're paying for.
Yeah.
You know, you can go to some of the top hotels and you're not quite sure what you get until you get there.
No. And so you can have the best of experiences. Sometimes you go, why have I paid twice as much for effectively my toilet roll to be folded into a swan or whatever it is?
Yeah.
And that is probably every market segment's like that. You've got, in your world, there'll be people that dominate because they're very clear about who they are, what they are, but they don't do a lot of things that you can do. You're more nimble and you can be shaped to a personal relationship. As long as everyone's comfortable with that, it's around, you're sitting around those big dominant players, isn't it, and offering something different, being clear about what your difference is.
Well I never will ever compete with the big design agencies because obviously that's not me, but I've worked on the agency side and I know how to differentiate from them. Basically, whether you're working on your own or you're in a big agency, if a client goes to either one of you, you'll get the same quality result, but you don't always get that personal touch when you go to big agencies because you go down the pecking line.
Yeah.
You know, the person you speak to as a business owner is not going to be the one that does the work.
Yeah.
And it's how the translation goes down the line.
Yeah.
So, it's, the expectations and what you're offering differently. Which happens in any business, really.
Yeah.
And it's keeping that customer focus and keeping in touch with your customers and finding out what the feedback is.
Yeah. We've just changed accountants in one of our businesses and we're paying more money and we're getting a superior service in many aspects of the business, but we've lost personal relationships, and we're struggling to come to terms with it actually
when you've said before, what your business you're comfortable with, you made a very conscious decision to keep it within bounds that you were you didn't want to expand it to places you didn't know, which is quite a big decision really when you know that you've got a winning formula,
yeah,
and you could probably and, you know, around the country,
yeah,
or around the world, even, you know, that idea. Yeah. But you know, you don't want to do that.
No, I think certainly at that moment in time, we chose
yes
not to do that, because actually the personal context that sat around it was completely wrong for the three of us to have done
yeah,
that.
Yeah, okay, right.
We had someone facilitate that conversation, actually, which I was going to talk about, but I didn't want to go into too much depth. But having an independent, very objective person to try and shape that conversation, really, really useful for us, that he helped us steer us to a direction that we're all comfortable with. I think we started that meeting all going in thinking we're all going to want different things. That was my big worry. We went in and I was ready to just say, I think we should slow this down a bit. But I was worried that the other two were going to say no. Now's the time to kick on. And actually, we were all second guessing each other a bit. We had someone facilitate that conversation.
Did you?
Yeah. And we all came out articulating pretty much the same thing, really, which is really quite nice. And it was very different to where we thought we started 3 years ago. And it might be that if we sit down and have that conversation again in 2 years' time, there might be an appetite for doing something outside of Sheffield potentially, but you'd be doing it in a much more like measured way, and you'd have to be clear about the criteria that you'd need to invest somewhere. What are the things that made Sheffield work in the first instance, and how, you know, that's the criteria by which you might choose your next location. But yeah, it fundamentally was all about we don't want to be on every street corner. We don't want to dominate people's thoughts. We just want to be known for being an interesting place that does its best at making.
Didn't you? You said you were involved with bigger corporates. Did you do?
Yeah, when I worked on the agency side.
Yes. Yeah. Because I did the same exercise with partners, and it wrecked the business.
Really?
Because we all turned out with exactly the opposite. We all thought we were thinking the same, and in fact we were on different planes.
But it's better know that, isn't it? It's better.
Oh, we found out, but I'm not sure. I don't think it was very constructive.
Right. Okay.
We could have gone down in a kind of a middle road.
Right.
Instead of highlighting the differences, which is what happened.
Right. Okay.
Rather than your case, it worked out great because, you know, everybody actually realised you were on the same.
Yeah. But,
you know, that's, and then suddenly the camaraderie or the magic, whatever, you know, what held them together suddenly became stuck.
Right.
And became uncomfortable then.
Yeah.
Which, you know, when I'm saying the big agencies and things, these things, you know, they are impersonal, I guess. But I find I'm learning that it's like reverse engineering it. So, you know, you don't feel comfortable in these. And I really genuinely think these places are going to struggle over the next 10 years to keep up, because people are wanting much more of a personal type thing.
Yeah,
I think so.
And they will listen. I just think it's a very interesting time at the moment.
Hello.
We've got people coming at your cousin.
Yeah.
You can connect the window. Yeah, he was just down there. God, this is halfway through.
Is this like a brief interlude where someone wants to come in?
I'm on the internet here, being officially recorded.
Oh, sorry.
I know. Yeah. Do you want to get involved?
This would be a great way to finish it.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. Just tell them we got here all right.
Well, that was about 6 days ago. But
right.
Yeah. So to be able to.
Well, actually, I think this is quite impressive.
I've seen all
the noise level now. You can hear it, can't you? When the door's open.
Yeah.
We've got some.
We've got deliveries going on. We've got people approaching the van for a chat in.
Why are you recording? Being recorded right now, so love you and leave you. There we go.
Now then, how do I finish that one off?
I don't know.
This is ridiculous. This is the longest one now.
Is it really? How long have we been?
40 minutes.
Really?
Oh my God. So better get some proper work done, eh?
I've got some work to do. I've got to go and talk to Laura next door. Right. Excellent. I'm going to shut it off. And that's the way it normally finishes.